My name is Bruce Birch, and this is All Things Reconsidered. This is All Things Reconsidered, coming to you on your radio. Tonight we have Steady from Ojai, California, who's going to be sharing with us a little bit about some stuff that he did. We're also going to have Peter from Tallahassee, Florida, where that hurricane's about to come ashore and wreak some havoc. And as usual, we have our roving correspondent from Sacramento, California, Geronimo, who's going to be talking to us a little bit about war. So sit back and give us a listen. This is All Things Reconsidered, coming to you out of your radio. Steady from Ojai, California, and Steady has been a regular on our program, and we've interviewed him a couple of times, and I understand that Steady, you've got a few things you wanted to discuss with us. One being the Cindy Sheehan situation, and a couple of other items. So, how are you doing? And let's get this thing rolling.
Yeah, I've actually really been looking forward to doing another show, and I have to confess that I've spent a lot of time listening to your show and Geronimo and Roy, and I think Sue, or was it Puck Lady Sue?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the show to me is just, that's the gathering, and we all have our position in the platform that you're providing. But to move right into the Cindy Sheehan, because that's pretty current, and, you know, I don't know exactly what happened. I went to a nice vigil here, and there was a wonderful turnout, and I read the next day that there was an unprecedented turnout. And then I think the next day after that, which was yesterday, we had her mother, Cindy Sheehan's mother, had a stroke.
Yeah.
And, you know, we really felt some energy at our vigil. And in the readings of people's posts afterwards, they had some. And to have her mother have a stroke at this time and to have her leave the post when the nation, you know, are rallying behind her and the loss of her son and Bush's five-week vacation, I just think it's kind of critical to examine that. Everyone's with her. Everyone wants her to be with her mom, and you know, go care for her family. But I also want to validate some people who might be pretty pissed off.
Sure.
And say, hey, she mobilized this many people. She's the skipper of this thing. She needed to go down with the ship, and to leave her post at that time might have not been the best thing to do for the development of solidarity that was occurring at that very moment.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think she really had the opportunity to consider that. She thought about her mom and split. But that's how fragile these things are. So I, you know, don't be discouraged in that. And when people are pissed off, try to understand that view, because we can't afford to lose another election.
I hear you. Well, you know, one thing, I haven't heard anyone express that. So it's kind of interesting have you heard that from some folks?
No, that's actually my position, and I guess, Not my position personally, but from being a military guy.
Okay.
And being
sure.
around people
Absolutely.
Who are committed to their causes.
Sure,
and
being,
you know,
yeah.
have sworn their life or to uphold the Constitution, not getting into the military macho, you know, BS. But from that hardliner standpoint,
right, the commitment.
She was the skipper, mm-hmm. and she was going to need to be the last one to leave there.
Yeah.
That's just the perspective that if someone came to, I haven't heard that, but I can see that. I felt the excitement behind her, and then I heard her mom had a stroke, and, like, my heart went, what?
Yeah.
You know, so it kind of took the wind out of the sails, if you will.
But, well, yeah, I think that in the commitment that she's made to this movement,
since Casey died, is definitely, I don't think she is abandoning it permanently, that she's probably tending to what she needs to do, and then she'll be back.
Yeah, God bless her. And anyone who's listening who you know, who's behind her or might disagree with that position that I took just now, you know, God bless you. And this, it was a sign of solidarity for the nation through Ms. Sheehan. And, you know, pray for her family. Send
Absolutely.
Her a card.
Absolutely.
I might even try to do that.
Absolutely.
I know Ojai sent a book of signatures, which was actually circulating around the theater when I showed that movie, Inside Iraq.
That's great.
And that went over not so well as far as the outcome, but we didn't lose any money on that. Mm-hmm. So people became informed, and I got to show the movie, and which we'll take right into the next topic there. I'm Zappa, and familiar with your work in veterans and
sure.
depleted uranium. I know people talk a lot about it, but since we spoke, I've come across another film which someone brought to my attention at the theater there.
Okay.
And it's called Beyond Treason.
Beyond Treason?
Yes.
Okay.
Maybe people are familiar with the Power Hour and their productions, but they produced this. It's right here in front of me, actually. A William Lewis film, Beyond Treason. And it, it's definitely a biased film. It's a hardcore assault, but not just, it has an amazing amount of documentation to present its cases of abandoning veterans who were submitted to or subject to chemical and biological and radiological experimentation, vaccines, without any real knowledge of what the vaccine was and what the purpose was. Serious, indicts leadership in the United States military apparatus for 5 decades.
Wow.
I'm not going to spend too much time on that, but here again, as one movie opened up, someone brought this to my attention, and they can check out that website at
www.beyondtreason.com. Beyondtreason.com, okay. Gotcha.
Just to get a whiff of what it is that I'm watching and is moving me. And in regards to whatever it is that you do or anyone else would do, there's lots, there's more, 48 hours in a day wouldn't be enough.
I can relate to that.
Oh, gosh.
I think that's the hardest part of this entire movement, if you will, is just that it takes more than one person. You have to bring others into the fold. I'm interested in this movie, though. So tell me about, does it go into the Gulf War syndrome, or does it just talk about things that have happened at the VA hospitals? Or
I would say more of the first one. It talks a lot about atomic veterans, if you will, or Gulf War illness, or the Gulf War syndrome, or the many different names that it's been given. But to quote one of the guys, one of the veterans in there, a staff sergeant who retired 2003, and he's a staff sergeant, I believe that's E6 in the Army.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Here's a guy who was essentially in the forward positions, and if you see the movie, he can say it. This is kind of paraphrased from him, but you know, they were blowing these weapons caches during the first dump under the heat of trying to withdraw from Iraq, and Schwarzkopf was part of that mission, so was Colin Powell. Schwarzkopf claimed in a Senate hearing that he tried to convince the senior commander to him that they were needed to retrograde it. The area was secured. And they said, no, there's no way that they could retrograde it. They don't want the Iraqis to fall back in on it, so blow it where it sits.
Wow.
So, I mean, somebody filmed the contents of some of this stuff, and there was, the color-coding bands on the drums of chemical warf agents and biological stuff,
and sand gas.
They had crates of munitions labeled England and Russia and United States. Seriously incriminating stuff. So the idea was not. Schwarzkopf was saying they don't want them to fall back in on it, but experts, after hearing the testimony, said, "Hey, they didn't want to be incriminated in there in the crates themselves.
They wanted to destroy the evidence."
So they destroyed the evidence, but without regard for forward positions that were downwind from these plumes and the fallout.
So all these soldiers essentially became infected by all this stuff.
Directly showered with WMD provided Saddam. Okay, those weapons were actually used on our troops. And worse off, you know, they used depleted uranium munitions. So now you add in the radiological element, and getting down to the science of that, and not to go too, take into too much time there, but, you know, you're talking about MOP gear, military occupational protection, or protective personal protective equipment with filters in the range that can filter contaminants up to 5 microns.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they knew, I mean, senior particle physicists from the Manhattan Project knew that when depleted uranium breaks up, it's going to be down in the 0.1, 0.2 micron range. They knew that.
Goodness.
And they issued these suits.
Okay, so essentially the infection ratio was 10 times what it could have been.
Yes. And, and you also have the false sense that you're protected, and you're not.
Yeah.
You're just not. And then they give them one suit, but as soon as you use that suit, you can't go using the suit over and over again.
Right. Once you come out of it, it's got to be destroyed.
If you have 1,000 troops there, you got 2 days, you need another 1,000 suits. And they just didn't have that. And then there was fraud in the suits and the stitching, and it was, you know, one hole in a chemical suit is the difference between life and death, and these were completely flawed. And the contractor was, you know, brought up on charges. They filed for bankruptcy and disappeared. Just another typical corporate scheme to get the income stream from the government.
This sounds like an amazing movie to watch. You know,
it's not for the faint of heart.
Yeah.
It shows pictures of defects. You know, newborns. It's just terrible to be, you know, chunks of flesh coming out. You know, they don't even ask in the movie. It says they don't even ask if it's a boy or a girl anymore. They ask if it's normal.
Jeez.
And they show pictures of veterans from the United States who've come home who've been exposed to these elements, and their children are looking the same. And it's not pretty.
Yeah.
It's very incriminating. And who's gonna talk about this stuff? Who's gonna bring this up in the election cycle? This is getting beyond, like the movie says, beyond treason. These are experimentations done on our military without their consent.
Yeah. Well, you know, the U.S. Army has been famous for doing stuff like that down through the years. Through the VA. I don't want to push you on time, but we're getting a little close.
I appreciate every minute.
Was there something else besides the Beyond Treason you wanted to touch on?
Well, that's new that's happening as far as things coming in just a stream off of, again, this
okay.
is just a branch off of the chat room and what has happened there.
Sure.
Other than staying up on top, I know the Navy had a couple of ships in Jordan that were shot at, and, you know, things are getting heightened with the withdrawal from Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
There are people flanking the outside area, and that's just a whole area to watch in the coming weeks. That's a powder keg over there.
It certainly is. You know, it makes me wonder, you know, what's going to... I heard an interesting thing the other day that Israel and, you know, the Israel-Iran feud, if you will, you know, is really going to get heated up with the nuclear situation that everybody's getting hyped up about.
Well, and just in a nutshell there, I believe Iran is entitled to their nuclear enrichment fuel cycle, and the world is watching what they're going to do with it, but the cons are not for that, because that represents cheap power.
It also represents...
with all the oil.
Sure, it represents freedom to them.
You can produce hydrogen when you start mastering or having enough nuclear capacity. You can produce hydrogen, and at that point, your fuel problems are solved.
Right. Well, you know, I told someone the other day that perhaps the answer would be to allow Iran to do that and give them a seat on the Security Council. They didn't like that answer.
I guess not. They've been trying. You know, they want to run this through the Security Council, but this is not a threat to the world.
Right.
And Putin's been the one sticking his foot down, saying, "No, you're not running anything through the Security Council because it's not a threat."
Right.
Things that are a threat go through the Security Council. That's not the appropriate channel. Try again, please.
Right. Exactly. as usual, I always appreciate talking with you. And next week, what we'll try to do is do a little bit of a longer segment than what we've done today. You always bring the greatest information, and I definitely appreciate that.
And again, the time that I have here with the listeners is precious, and I appreciate every minute that I get. So, Zappa, I'll have a new list, and I'll have been caught up. I'll be done with all most of my digging around here.
Okay. Well, you know, I definitely appreciate it, Steady.
Thank you.
Okay.
You have a great evening.
You too.
Okay.
Okay. Peter from Tallahassee, Florida, on the line with me, and Peter's going to be talking to us about the truth and why we're not getting it. So, Peter, how you doing? And man, you've got the mic.
Well, great, great. Bruce, I appreciate some time to voice some of the things I want to talk about, and I've got to say the name of your site, The Truth Is Us, is an appropriate forum for me to get into this. And the comments that I want to make this evening are in response to the hate speech that Robertson delivered this past week, and it's a response to the continual lies of Falwell and Dobson and Bush, and my comments are also about Democrats who will not call the president a liar, and by not doing so, they themselves are becoming liars. And I want to talk about the truth and about the Antichrist and about the moneyed, self-righteous who would take both the church and the country from us. I'll begin by saying that Pat Robertson is an embarrassment to the church and a danger to American politics.
Okay.
Robertson is known for irresponsible statements. He said that the 9/11 terrorist attacks were caused by American feminists and gays and liberals. He said that only if you could only vote for George Bush if you were a true Christian, that Christians would have to vote for George Bush or they wouldn't be a Christian. He said that the judiciary is a greater threat to America than those who flew the planes into the Trade Center. He even took credit for diverting a hurricane. But the latest outburst about Chavez, it takes first place. And Chavez is a democratically elected leader. He won no less than 3 internationally certified elections. He's yet to commit any holocausts. His human rights record doesn't even approach that of Latin American dictators who are responsible for massive violations of human rights and the death of tens of thousands of people. Robertson never criticized them, and I think that's because many of them were supported by the U.S. military aid program.
Mm-hmm.
Just gives you a picture of what his priorities are. And I won't even get into Falwell and Dobson and Bush's lies. I'm really just tired of the receipt. Or the deceit, I should say.
the receipt of the deceit.
They're going to get a receipt, by the way. And when this is over, they're all going to be clocked out.
There you go.
There's a standard, and it's called truth. And the standard of truth predates the Ten Commandments, and it predates Moses, and it predates written history. And I believe that when the creatures that we evolved from began making grunts and squeals that were understood by others of their kind, truth became a standard. And my personal feeling is that evil entered the world when the first lie was grunted or squealed by one of those primitive beings, and that mankind has been spinning lies ever since. And I'm going to get a little biblical on you here at the beginning, but we'll switch to a political gear a little further in. First chapter of Genesis teaches us the power of words. Genesis 1 verse 2 reads, "The earth was without form and empty waste, and darkness was upon the face of the great deep. And God said, let there be light, and there was light." And from this we learn that worlds are created with words. Words create reality. Words create countries, create borders, create relationships, and create communities. Lies are words, too. And being words, they have the power to create.
Sure.
They create wars. They create murder. They create hatred, jealousy, and prejudice against each other. The gospel speaks of truth, and it teaches us its proper place in our hearts and minds. In Philippians, we find, finally, brethren, whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are noble, whatsoever things are just, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are lovely, whatsoever things are of good report, meditate on these things. In other words, the gospel teaches us to walk in truth.
Sure.
There are hundreds of references to truth in the Bible. And Jesus amplified that theme when he said, I am the truth and the light dispels the darkness. Now, this leads into what I'll have to say about the Antichrist.
Okay.
The letters of 1 John were written in a situation of very great controversy in the early life of the church. The content of the gospel was at stake, nothing less. The controversy revolved around how to follow Jesus in the end times. And yes, the Christians even then thought we were living in the end times. We've been living in the end times for 2,000 years.
That's a long time.
Reading the epistles of John reveals the implications of that controversy. And John is trying to promote the view of Christian discipleship based on the care of the neighbor who's in need of food and shelter. And John is struggling with a faction of the church who believes that because they're living in the end times, they should think of their own salvation and their own needs only. And for John, to follow Jesus, it meant helping with the material needs of others. So in the context of the end times dispute, John raises the concept of the Antichrist. And this is the only place in all of Scripture where the Antichrist is mentioned. He tells us four things. In 1 John we read, Dear children, as you have heard, the Antichrist is coming. Even now, many Antichrists, plural, have come. Notice that Antichrist is plural. Many Antichrists have come, and they have emerged from within the church. Do you see how true that is? The evil leadership of this country, Robertson, Falwell, and Dobson professing Christ, it makes me sick. In 1 John 2:22, it reads, Who is the liar? It is the man who denies Christ. Such a man is the Antichrist. He denies the Father and the Son. So here we see that the Antichrist is the one who denies Christ. And there are many ways to deny Christ. But these days, the main way to deny Christ is to lie. And it is also manifested today by the lifting up of the Bible, not Christ, as being pure. The Bible is simply a signpost that points us to Jesus. And worship of the Bible is idolatry, or bibliolatry, to be more precise. 1 John 4:3 reads, But every spirit that does not acknowledge Jesus is the spirit of the Antichrist and is even now in the world. Here we see plural again, every spirit. And we see that the Antichrist is spirituality. In 2 John, we find many deceivers who do not acknowledge Jesus Christ have gone out into the world. Any such person is the deceiver and the Antichrist. Notice the word many deceivers. Now, I think this clearly states that we've been warned about the Robertsons and the Dobsons and the Falwells and the Bushes of this world. In Matthew, Jesus said, Many will say to me, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name, and in your name drive out demons and perform many miracles? Then I will tell them plainly, I never knew you. Away from me, you evildoers. And I think we would do well to say the same thing to the Dobsons and the Robertsons of this world. I want to make a couple of points about this stuff. The first is that contemporary preachers these days, the end times preachers, they have willfully distorted the words of the Bible, and they have utterly fabricated and invented the character of a mythical figure or Antichrist that appears at the very end of history to conquer the world. It simply isn't in the Bible. What is in the Bible is the concept of the Antichrist filling many deceivers who are already among us. So why would the right want you to think that the Antichrist is a future thing, not here yet, coming down the road? Well, that's an easy one. It lets them off the hook, and it's so you won't question their lies or suspect them for being the evil bastards that they are. And secondly, the warning that John does give us about the spirit of the Antichrist is that it comes from within the church. And it seems to have, this is an implied thing, but it seems to have a refusal to love others through the sharing of worldly goods. Sound familiar? I believe the spirit of Antichrist is alive and active within our political and spiritual cultures today. And at this point, I'm going to switch over to a political gear.
Okay.
Maybe sound a little fall-ish myself.
Before we do that, yeah. You know, I had a couple of questions I kind of wanted to throw at you.
Great.
Over this, you know, I think it's absolutely fantastic that you've pointed this out, because I think one of our biggest problems with the Bible as a living document is that so many do not see it as a living document. They see it as, you know, as something that is to be translated in literally, and not looked at as a guidebook rather than, you know, something that's a you know, word for word, letter by letter.
It's true.
You know, and you know, you live down in Tallahassee. I live up here in North Carolina. We live at one end of the Bible Belt from the other.
Don't we, though? And haven't we both seen it all?
Yes. You know, all in the name of you know, the Bible. But the entire concept about many antichrists rather than the one really intrigues me, because, you know, it's my belief that, you know, there's a passage in Matthew that says, you know, if you've done this to the least of these, you have done it unto me.
Christian charity.
Yes, which is basically saying, you know, if you've given to someone, you've also given to me. And I believe very strongly that, you know, we have to act as if there, you know, were Jesus standing right in front of us, for those who believe in Jesus.
I agree with you.
At all times. So it is very unfortunate that we have people who have the microphones in the world, who have the television stations and the mantles of leadership, who are propagating myths.
Absolutely. It's important for folks to realize that the media is treating the church in the same way that it's treating the government. It's putting out the lies, it's putting out the hate speech. It's the media is a whore.
Yes.
And it's true there are churches that preach that, but I assure you there are other Christian voices in this country that speak articulately and they speak lucidly and they speak the truth. And I'm with you, brother. I tell you, it's hard to take some days, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And you know, and I actually work for a Christian organization. I'm not going to name that organization, but you know, I deal with everyone from the liberal Episcopalian reverend to the independent fundamental Baptist preacher, you know, who is trying to lure me away from whatever church I'm going to make, you know,
to go to his. Stealing.
Yes, yes. So, you know, I know very well the various types of folks that are in, you know, who are walking around today doing that. But I do, like I said, I just wanted to commend you on that, because I'd never really thought about that before, and I'm sure that there are some others out there that are going to be enlightened by that.
Well, I hope so, and this is such a relief to get this out in a public forum, because this has been churning around in circles inside me for a long, long time, and I have no place to put it.
Well, now
you've
got a
place. Thank God for you and what you're doing, because at least it's out there.
Absolutely. Well, go ahead and shift gears then. We're going from second to third, baby.
Well, I will. And the political side of this is I want to give the listeners a view into how the hell this happened.
Okay.
And it happened, let me start at the beginning. In the 70s, there was a huge cultural shift, and it was taking place all over the country. And Supreme Court Justice Lewis Powell authored a memo and sent it out to various conservative organizations. And in it, Powell argued that the conservative movement needed to build an alternative media and a cultural infrastructure to combat the growing divide in the country. And the growing divide, you'll remember, was the emergence of the liberation movements, civil rights, environmental movement, women's and gay and lesbian
basically
rights.
The progressive movement, right?
Say again, please?
I said basically just the progressive movement.
Yes, yes, us.
Mm-hmm.
Us.
Okay.
We are the enemy. And, there's also a new awareness about the war. The curtain was lifted on the Vietnam War, and And people saw it for what it was. There was government corruption. It lied to people. It enriched a few people and spilled the blood of thousands. Mm-hmm. And the elites were worried. Too much of the power was slipping away from those who think they were born to rule. And so they went to work, and they began building institutes like the Heritage Foundation and the American Enterprise Institute. And the they that I'm talking about are wealthy donors. And as the infrastructure began to take root, they realized that churches were strategic to bring about the control of wealth and the values in our country. And they set out to co-opt the churches through the use of parachurch agencies. One of them I'm going to talk about is the Institute on Religion and Democracy is one of those funded agencies. And it's run by, get this, ex-CIA asset Mark Tooley. That's right, a CIA guy.
Well, you know, it's something else that's interesting is that in the name it says democracy.
Yeah, right.
Rather than the Institute on Religion and the Republic.
Yeah. And I love the way religion is sort of stirred in there like some sort of soup. The Institute of Religion and Democracy, I'll just call it the IRD, spent over $350,000 in 2001 to monitor the activities and the leaders and the public policy statements of the Methodist Church alone. In the last 20 years, the IRD has spent over $4.4 million monitoring and undermining mainline churches in general. And in one of those documents, it's called Reforming America's Churches Project, 2001 through 2004. That's the name of it. The IRD states that its purpose is to change the permanent governing structure of mainline churches so they can help renew the wider culture of our nation. In other words, the IRD wants to enforce a takeover of the church for the benefit of the government, not the gospel.
Well, okay, so just to sort of interject something here is crossing my mind, do you think that they're responsible for this huge onslaught of all these mega churches lately?
Well, surely their hands are in it. You know, you have to start a church like that, you have to have money. And Lord knows where it's all going and how it's beginning to form these huge, almost they're almost cities, some of them. But I find it a little hard to believe that these mega churches are rising out of storefronts.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely.
Little storefront churches,
sure.
Down here in the South. Some of the people might not know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But it's a government takeover of the church, are well funded.
Okay.
And the IRD, it's funded by the same right wing. I won't use the word. They funded the takeover of the Southern Baptist Church, and all the players are there. The Scaife Foundation is given over $1.9 million. The Howard Amiston, he serves on the Dominionist Board of the Chalcedon Institute. He gives a reported $75,000 yearly. And, of course, Dominionism is a theocratic movement, and it claims that Christians are to rule the world with force if necessary. And I encourage you to check it out. It's called the Eureka Report, and their website is www.eurekareport.com. That's spelled Y-U-R-I-C-A-R-E-P-O-R-T.com, Eureka,
okay.
Port. And also the John Olin Foundation, the Adolph Kors family, Lynn Harrison Bradley Foundation, they've all given multiple thousands of dollars to the IRD for the purpose of promoting the culture wars in church congregations, and through them, the culture wars in this country.
Wow.
And essentially the IRD and the right-wing funding sources are trying to disrupt the witness of mainline churches. They are crucifying the cause of Christ for the purpose of diminishing the nation's social conscience. And their goal is power and its control. And they want to return to the biblical age of Pharaoh, who owned the land and owned the livestock and owned the labor of the people. What's at stake in all of this is the gospel. These people are trying to possess the soul of the church. The theology they preach offers a perverted understanding of Jesus. Their Jesus makes demands on the poor, blames the poor for their poverty, and assumes that the well-off are that way because they alone receive God's blessings and God's favors. Their Jesus makes distinctions between saints and sinners and excludes people who don't pass the moral righteousness test. Their Jesus supports anti-labor anti-environmental economy. And there Jesus willingly straps on helmets and boots and guns and creates a macho Christ and a righteous warrior. And, you know, the scripture of this Jesus is narrow-minded, wants obedience, wants conformity, and just wants single-minded thoughts and values. It's horrifying. There Jesus has become the dominant image of Christ in our culture. It's manipulated congregations into embracing a theocratic theology. They've become obsessed with righteousness and holiness codes and dangerous idolatry of the nation and dangerous idolatry of the president. It's a hard-edged Jesus, and he stays arm's length from the poor and those who are seeking a fair distribution of wealth. And, you know, I've ranted for a while, but I'll sum it up in just a short sentence. And I fully believe that, like John, in the epistles that I read earlier, we are engaged also with the spirit of the Antichrist. And we are engaged in a contest for the soul of the church, and we are engaged in a contest for the soul of the nation. It's serious, and it's real, and it goes all the way to the bone. And, you know, we will overcome this. This cannot stand. We all know it. As citizens of this country, we grew up here. We know this cannot stand. These lies will come out. They will be exposed. But my God, the hell they've put us through.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know what? It may get worse before it gets better.
Dear Lord, I just don't see how it could get much worse, Bruce. But
we have forums like this in which to express, you know, what we need to express. And they can't take that away from us.
No, sir. They can't take that away from us.
So, well, that's pretty powerful stuff.
Well,
Peter.
I don't do this often, Bruce. So when I do it, it really comes out. Because if I did it every day, it would probably be milder. But that's it. That's it. That's what I have on my heart.
Okay. Well, and you know what? And I appreciate it. One of the things that. That I gleaned out of this already is just to be ever watchful for those people around me who perhaps may not have my best interest at heart.
Exactly.
I definitely appreciate it. You know, we're running a little short on time, so we're going to have to go ahead and cut this off. But
yes,
Peter, I wanted to say thank you very much for.
And thank you. I appreciate you, and I appreciate what you're doing.
Allowing yourself to be interviewed, and we'll do this again real soon.
I hope so. Maybe there's another volcano in there. I'll look.
Well, now that you've cleared this one out of the way, I'm sure there will be another one.
I'm sure there's something else going on.
All right. Well, Peter, listen, you have a great evening.
Thanks, buddy. You have a good one, too.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye now. Okay, I'm on the line today with Geronimo of Sacramento, California, and Geronimo is going to be talking with us today about war. What is it about war that we're going to be talking about?
Well, something seems to be going on that nobody either realizes or nobody's talking about, and that's the normalization of war as part of the American psyche.
Okay.
So let me tell you what I mean by this. The first couple hundred years of our country, the size of the military depended on an immediate threat. After the threat, after a threat happened, an army was raised up. But then when the threat was over, the army was dismantled. This happened in 1865, 1918, and 1945. Now, to me, this is what normal countries do. I was born in 1940, and in 1945, after World War II, there was a peaceful atmosphere in the United States. People were more into community awareness. The only mass media we had was the radio. The country had pulled together during World War II. My mother worked in an airplane factory. People made victory gardens. People made do without. Like, you know, there wasn't any nylon or hardly any. I think they were being used for parachutes. And so And back in those days, the Maryland used to have like a little, they were like sewed together and on one side.
Sure.
And there was a little seam up a woman's leg. Well, I remember my mother using an eyebrow pencil down the back of her leg to make it look like she had nylons on. There weren't that many cars because a lot of rubber went to tires for Jeeps and airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
So, but, you know, even though I was a little kid, I mean, I was pretty aware. There was very little evidence of military consciousness. My mother owned an apartment building, and of course, a lot of people were in the war, so some of the apartment inhabitants, I saw their uniforms. I saw the uniforms hanging in the closet and so on, but, you know, it wasn't part of the American psyche as far as being a military power.
Right.
So, like, then the Cold War came, and, you know, McCarthy stoked that with the Red Menace in the early 50s. But all during the Cold War, I felt safe because I lived in this big country. There were two oceans on each side. There was no threats from in our hemisphere, north or south. We had these big missiles aimed at the USSR. Yes, there was the sword of Damocles hanging over our head because there could be nuclear war any minute. But I was thinking, you know, as far as an invasion, that just wasn't going to happen.
Right. That's just a really sort of a outlandish concept, huh?
Yeah, I know. I won't go into that right now.
Right.
About that. But all the time that the Cold War was going on, I thought, you know, well, one of these days, the country will return to what's considered normal. We can spend money on our people and things that mattered, education, you know, free college education and
right.
healthcare and that kind of stuff. But what it turned out to be is, like, after 40 years of military buildup, the United States was a supreme military presence and had become part of our psyche. And military power was valued for its own sake. And I think the United States became drunk with power after World War II, the leaders became enamored with military might. And if you remember, in the 2004 election, Kerry, you know, framed his differences with W on the war in Iraq in terms of tactics, but not on first principles. I think Kucinich was the only one that was saying, hey, let's have a Department of Peace.
Right.
So this new, because I knew what the United States was like in a peaceful time when it wasn't militaristic, I've noticed that, you know, that there's certain things that have manifested with this new American militarism. And one of them is the scope and cost of this militarism. The United States has dispensed with the defense principle because there's like no one out there who can, you know, deal with us hardly. But now the military is committed to maintaining a military capacity far in excess of need. Like the Navy has 12 large attack carriers, aircraft carriers, but there's no battle fleet in the world, you know, that has a ship which is equal to a Nimitz-class carrier, which is, you know, the size of 3 football fields and is powered by a nuclear reactor. And we have 4 separate air forces, you know, one for, like, each branch of the military. We spend more on defense than all the other nations of the world combined, depending on how you look at it. The 2009 Pentagon budget is 23% over the average of Cold War spending. And yet nobody questions this. It's just taken for granted. You know, all this money going down the Pentagon rat hole that we could be using for, like, other stuff, and, you know it's being wasted with Halliburton and you know, what they're doing, you know, Pentagon losing billions of dollars. Well, it's now been 16 years since the USSR fell, and the United States still has bases and troops in over 100 countries. And yet there's little controversy about this, but, you know, oftentimes these countries can protect themselves.
Sure.
And the American public, you know, thinks of troops around the globe with the same laissez-faire attitude they think of the cop, you know, on the local street.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this military supremacy has affected the mindset of the officer corps. Military dominance constitutes a baseline now from which to scale to even greater heights of supremacy, which to me is like overkill, and like now they want to militarize space. So this military supremacy has led to a propensity to use force, which has led to the normalization of war. Now, until recently, politicians hesitated to send troops abroad. I think from 1945 to about 1988, there were about 6 military actions, you know, Korean War,
sure,
Vietnam, and so on. But since 1989, these military actions are almost annual events. And the public has become accustomed, perhaps comfortable with, you know, opening up their warning paper and seeing that the U.S. troops are responding to, like, some crisis somewhere. And these crises seem to be becoming a permanent condition, and, well, so is war. And remember, W. described the war on terror as lasting for decades. Now, to me, this constant war status is not normal. Before policymakers treated or pretended to treat the use of force as evidence that diplomacy had failed. Remember that? You remember that?
Yes.
Now Cheney says, force makes your diplomacy more effective, unquote. And our military planners now presume that whenever or wherever our forces engage will be the result of the U.S. choosing to launch a war. And W said this, that the big lesson of 9-1-1 was that, quote, this country must go on the offense and stay on the offense. Now, to see how far the process of U.S. militarization has advanced, half of the public has readily accepted the prospect of war without a foreseeable end, and a policy that abandons all pretense of the U.S. fighting defensively or viewing war as a last resort. Now, along with this new militarism has come a new aesthetic of war. In the 20th century view, war was barbarism, brutality, ugliness, and sheer waste, you know, evidence of the world wars in Vietnam. And this was reflected in art by Ernest Hemingway and Ernest Maria Remarque. You know, you see that French guy that wrote All Quiet on the Western Front?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then movies like Apocalypse Now, Platoon, and Full Metal Jacket. And this art reflected the modern battlefield as a slaughterhouse orgy of destruction, where the guilty and the innocent, you know, alike are killed. And also, the military services were depicted as a degrading experience, by nature very repressive and inhumane. Now, only the fascists since 1914 have celebrated war and depicted armies as forward-looking, as expressions of national unity and a collective purpose in paving the way to utopia. Sounds familiar?
Yeah.
Now, in the 21st century, we have this new war paradigm. The era of mass armies and mechanized warfare is over. Now we have high-tech warfare by skilled professionals with smart weapons. You know, and even the military lexicon has changed. You know, now war is considered surgical, postmodern, abstract, or virtual. And war is now coercive diplomacy, not necessarily to kill, but to persuade. And this is really hideous. War has been turned into a spectator sport.
Mm-hmm.
Spectator sport, one offering the added thrill that it is real for someone, but not happily for the American spectator. And in the right circumstances, war can offer attractive options, the attractive option of being cost-effective, humane, and even thrilling. You remember the race to Baghdad on TV? You know, with the bombs going off and all that, and it was like a pageant. It's like performance art, you know, kind of wake people up from maybe from the ennui of their daily lives. And the public had a real enthusiasm for this whiz-bang technology of the military. And this enthusiasm was also reinforced by the American public perception that they were at a safe distance from the war. Now, to me, this is like a total reality, the disconnect, because there's, like, you know, people dying over there. Another thing this new militarism has done is it's boosted the status of military institutions in the United States, you know, to a level that they were not before, and also boosted the status of the soldiers themselves. Now, since the Cold War, opinion polls have ranked the armed services first above the Congress, the courts, you know, any other institution. The military is seen as exemplifying virtues cherished by earlier generations, traditional values, and old-fashioned virtues. And the soldiers are starting to believe this hype, and this is worrisome. Retired Admiral Stanley Arthur has expressed concern that, quote, more and more enlisted as well as officers are beginning to feel that they are special, better than the society they serve, unquote. Okay. Such tendencies, concluded Arthur, is, quote, not healthy for an armed force serving a democracy, unquote. I would say so. In public life today, paying homage to those in uniform has become obligatory. And the one unforgivable sin is to be found guilty of failing to support the troops. And the right-wingers have developed considerable skill in exploiting this dynamic by shamelessly pandering to the military and by extension to those members of the public laboring under the misconception from the old Vietnam War days that the armed services are under siege from a rapidly anti-military left. But the fact is that the democratic mainstream, if only to save itself from extinction, has long since purged itself of any dovish inclinations. Although there was opposition, millions of people were filling the streets in protest before the Iraq War, hardly any mainstream politicians were willing to object and to be seen as not supporting those that W was sending to Iraq. So even these leftist do-gooders want to harness the military power that we have to intervene in humanitarian crises abroad. You know, I don't know, Somalia, that kind of stuff. So it seems like the whole political spectrum is in thrall at this, you know, military might that we have. And W has styled himself as the nation's first full-fledged warrior president. Remember when he landed on the Kiri USS?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In full flight regalia, you know, to bask in the adulteration of the crew. Well, that was lifted directly from the triumphant scene, the final scene in the movie Top Gun.
Sure.
So for this nationally televised event, W was not simply mingling with the troops. He had merged his identity with their own and made himself one of them. In other words, the president is warlord.
Well, and you know, not to interrupt you, but there's a lot of indication that he saw himself as a wartime president for a long time prior to even invading Iraq, and but that's for a different topic for a different day.
That's true, yeah, because he thought that was one of the things for, you know, to one of the indications of being considered a successful president. Was to be seen as the commander-in-chief.
Yeah, and he has statuettes all over his office of all the wartime presidents.
I know, it's disgusting.
Yeah.
In earlier times, Americans and me considered history as a peaceful continuum interrupted by war. I mean, I think that's the normal state of things. That's what it's supposed to be, not being in perpetual war. Today, planning, preparing, and waging war has become the normal state and seemingly permanent condition of the United States. And the only accepted, quote, plan, unquote, for peace is a loaded pistol. So how much time we got left? Cause
we're looking good. We got about 8 minutes or seven minutes.
All right. Well, you know, when Ike left office in January of 1961, he gave this speech where he mentioned the phrase the military-industrial complex.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I always liked Ike and paid close attention to him. And that haunted me for a long time because I had no idea what he meant. Well, now I do. And I have I've got about five paragraphs of that speech that I'd like to read here, which, you know, I think is very applicable to what we're talking about.
Please do.
So Ike said, our military organization today bears little relation to that known to any of my predecessors in peacetime, or indeed by the fighting men of World War II or Korea. Until the latest of our world conflicts, the United States had no armaments industry. American makers of plowshares could, with time and as required, make swords as well. But now we can no longer risk emergency improvisation of national defense. We have been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions. Added to this, 3.5 million men and women are directly engaged in the defense establishment. We annually spend on military security more than the net income of all United States corporations. This conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large armed industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We must take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals so that security and liberty may prosper. Prophetic.
Very much so, yes.
The way, you know, the military establishment is going now is, you know, it just directs me right into those sci-fi movies, Starship Troopers 1 and 2, which shows a future fascist society where the military is glorified. And also into, you know, and we're kind of living in 1984, too, with all the misinformation, Orwellian language.
Mm-hmm.
Remember I told you I read those two books, War of the Racket?
Yes.
Well, Brigadier General Smedley Butler. I didn't talk about it too much before, but when he died in 1940, he was the most decorated serviceman that the United States had seen. I forget how many medals he had.
Wow.
And he mentioned that he was a hitman for corporations on three continents. And a guy wrote a book recently, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, but that's a different kind of hitman, I think.
Mm-hmm.
The fascists tried to take over the government in 1933, and they approached Smedley to help them, and he foiled the attempt. He testified before Congress in 1934 about this. In his book, War is a Racket, he says that, you know, a racket is something which is known by the few, the elitists in this case. And in war, the few profit and many lose, who are usually the poor who fight and pay the taxes to pay for the war. And they get the poor to fight by, you know, using patriotic slogans and appealing to people's sense of community,
mm-hmm.
You know, extended nationally. And there's really is a lot of motivation for manufacturers for war because profits are up, you know, sometimes 2,000% in wartime.
Right.
And it isn't just the weapons manufacturers. There's people like shoe manufacturers, T-shirt manufacturers, rope makers, you know, because all that's needed. Smedley is saying, he listed some points of you know, how to stop this, is, you know, for everyone who's contributing to the war effort, you know, all those industries, the CEO should have the same salary as the workers. That would probably stop them. There wouldn't be any profit in it. Plus, the people who get to vote on whether or not to go to war should be the common people who are doing the fighting.
Mm-hmm.
Which makes sense to me.
Well, you know, just as an aside, I was reading something yesterday that said that the highest paid CEO in the United States presently is the president of a company that's that contracts with the Department of Defense.
Of course.
So.
Of course.
Just that backs up your claim there.
The other thing is, remember Tom's book, The Prophet's Way?
Mm-hmm.
We were talking about that last week, and Tom mentions difference between old cultures and young cultures. And I
yes.
think, you know, now we're seeing the time of the young culture, especially young cultures leading our country.
Mm-hmm.
Young cultures tend to view themselves as separate from the earth and want dominion over it. They view the earth's resources only as things to be used and discarded. They consider nature to be the enemy and not to be revered. Young cultures are egocentric, arrogant, they have limited vision, greed, and they're immature, which, you know, certainly seems to describe our present government to me. They think that the act of thinking is consciousness. They're interested in themselves to the exclusion of the larger community in which they live. These cultures think little of promulgating wars because the people who are there aren't human, right? They don't count. They think that God is distant, heaven is far away in time and space, and that humans are separate and unique and have to grab what they can. Younger cultures do not see God in all life and are ready to destroy the world for profit and power, which is, you know, that's why I think the conservatives are very limited in their thinking. You know, they're really young and immature. They
mm-hmm.
don't think of beyond themselves. Whereas the older cultures, which I think exemplify the liberals more, the older cultures feel an intrinsic connection to the earth, that the earth is a living organism that has its own consciousness. Older cultures understand mankind's place on earth. Older cultures believe in harmony and living together. And older cultures view living things as interrelated and interconnected. And when you view living things as interrelated and interconnected, you can't be just willingly going off and, like, bombing people, you know, for kicks or profit or whatever. You can't do that. Older cultures think that our thoughts have meaning and impact, that we are all part of a larger, more encompassing consciousness, a consciousness that touches an experience beyond thought. And this has to do with being, with the way that we are. Older cultures do not promulgate a message of separation like the younger cultures do. Younger cultures think it's like it's us or them, or us versus them.
Right.
Whereas the older cultures think it's we. It's us.
Well, again, thank you so very much. And we'll do this again next week.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks for calling, Zap.
Okay.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
this is Bruce Birch, and I'd like to say thank you for dropping in to our wonderful show this evening. If you'd like to learn more about All Things Reconsidered, you can reach us on the web at www.thetruthisus. That's www.thetruthis.us/ATR. And if you'd like, stay tuned for Peter Werby, who's coming up next. And Peter, you can reach him at his website, which is peterwerby.com. And we will see you next week. This is Bruce Birch for All Things Reconsidered.